Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Stephen Hausman, your host for New Books in the American West. Today, I'm happy to welcome to the podcast Robert Foxkern, an independent scholar and former professional historian for the Boeing Corporation. Robert is the co-author, along with Michelle Bouchard and Sebastian Mallet, of Songs Upon the Rivers, the buried history of the French-speaking Canadiens and Métis from the Great Lakes and the Mississippi across to the Pacific, which was published in 2016 with Baraka Books. Robert, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, likewise, most glad to have the opportunity.
Before we begin, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? What's your background, and how did you become interested in history generally and the history of the French legacy in the American West in particular?
A long and circuitous route, doubt, but short version is ended up working for Boeing in their Paris office about 28, 30 years ago, and my game plan to write a significant modern integrated work on the story of Huguenots, including my ancestry along that line, the French Huguenots, French Calvinist Protestants in North America, got derailed and headed off on another route, that of the French Canadian and Métis across the North American continent. I realized that that was a much bigger story, and I needed to go after someone else's story, not my family background. This occurred while stationed in Paris for a couple of years by Boeing, and maps that were available there at their National Geographic Institute and elsewhere made it clear that there were still pockets of French-speaking people in the Pacific Northwest and elsewhere in the American West, more than just New England and Southern Louisiana, which puzzled me thoroughly. And there was a certain amount of credibility issues involved. But I went after it and realized that in fairly short order that up till a half century ago, there were a fairly large number of French-speaking Native Americans in the American West. And clues along those lines came from working in the Boeing Paris office for a French-speaking Abenaki Indian, retired U.S. Air Force general, then working for Boeing, and my dad's cousins who were Osage. And in response to the question, said, of course, all of us have French-Canadian or French Creole great-great-great-grandpas. That's business as usual, standard stuff. So then traveling around the country, I became more and more curious and saw more and more clues and thought maybe definitely there's some squirrels in that tree. And I started barking.
How did you become involved in this book project in particular with Michelle and Sebastian?
Well, it was via a mutual friend of Michelle's and mine, Dean Lauder, who was a geographer at the University of Laval. He had gotten his PhD, coincidentally, locally here at UW Seattle, University of Washington. And as a geographer, he and his partner of in the world of geography, Eric Waddell, had spent most of their career mapping out all the pockets of French speakers from Louisiana and across the West, putting out books like Franco-Amérique and, I'm not going to start listing the titles because most of these haven't been translated and they're in French and nobody needs to hear that. But in any case, worthwhile if anybody reads French at least, which shouldn't be all that difficult since most of our words in our history books actually came right out of French 700, 800 years ago. That's the probably more than anybody needs to know about stumbling into this path.
Well, sorry, you can continue. I interrupted you.
Oh, no, I would. But the next thing I would have to say is simply I've got a couple of short citations that I think are very telling as far as the significance of what we're talking about in our book, Songs Upon the Rivers. If you're ready for that.
Sure. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. One, I would, of all the phenomenal amount of worthy publication coming out of the American Midwest in the last 15 or so years, and I'll make quick reference to a few of those at some point, but Jay Gitlin's Bourgeois Frontier, French Towns, French Traders, and American Expansion, one sentence taken out of his book goes a long ways to saying what we're trying to say, though he uses the word French in the American West instead of, you know, the most of them were Canadiens or Canadians and with a backfill of Creoles. But the one sentence says it all version here from Bourgeois Frontier by Jay Gitlin. The true legacy of the French in the American West is the role they played in Western expansion in negotiating the course of American empire. That we must acknowledge. So that I think gives it on the short. And then I have another clarification. As far as the actual impact of where this series of books is going, I would bring you to another Midwestern historian, R. David Edmonds, in the preface to his book, The Potawatomi, Keepers of the Fire, a major tribe around Lake Michigan and within Michigan State. As in two centuries ago. And he introduces the reader to the longer-term impact of the tribe's regional alliances, trade, and intermarriage going well beyond the lines and dates and coloring in our conventional historic atlases. He points out in the preface to this book, The Potawatomi, as I began my research into Potawatomi history, certain patterns slowly appeared which attracted my interest. By far the most prominent of these patterns was that of the Potawatomi ties to New France. During the colonial period, the Potawatomi emerged as the most faithful of all of France's red allies. Indeed, the close Potawatomi-French relationship continued well after the official French withdrawal from the Midwest, playing a major role in tribal acculturation patterns in the 19th century. The Potawatomi mixed bloods are of particular interest, since they led the tribe through the removal period. A product of two and sometimes three cultures, many of these mixed bloods subscribed more to the value systems of the Creole French traders than to either Potawatomi or American ideals. They served as mediators between the red and the white communities, often protecting Potawatomi interests, but also amassing personal fortunes in their negotiations with the federal government. Frontier opportunists, the mixed bloods offer an interesting study in acculturation. And then I would just say simply, similar roles, outcomes, and controversies would occur for virtually all the other tribes across the northern borderlands of the U.S. all the way to the Pacific. And that's what the later volumes in the series deal with. So that opportunism, cultural intermediaries and such. So that's it as far as a couple of introductory citations.
Yeah, those two quotes really do summarize pretty well what it is that the three of you are trying to accomplish in this book. I feel like those are good. Let's jump into the book a bit by having you tell us a little about some of the stories that you begin the book with. In particular, tell us where the French Empire and where French history traditionally come into play in narratives told about the American West. How do French-speaking people play into the kind of the typical narratives that you hear about the West?
That's kind of varied over time as far as American historiography. They were marginalized pretty quickly. And they had their numbers and presence reduced both quantitatively and qualitatively as far as individual character and behavior and such. So they were actually mentioned as kind of useful idiot background characters early on in American histories of the West. And over time, they virtually disappeared from the history of the American West, especially as dime novels and journalists found it lucrative to cater to the audience back east and reinvent the West along the lines that Americans wanted to hear it and see it and read it. The net result of that is that a very well-documented presence, be it people's journals, other non-French-speaking people's observations, to the Catholic Church records, to government records, and in particular Bureau of Indian Affairs documentation, there is an enormous amount of original source material referring to these people if one gets below the conventional history of the American West routine. And nowadays, they've, except for probably the history of the American Midwest, they're still out of the picture, as we will mention a little later in this discussion. Reminded most recently with that movie, The Revenant, where basically all the French Canadian and Matisse in their several minutes in and out of the story were simply cowards, kidnappers, murderers, lynchers, rapists, and such. There's not another ethnic group on the planet that would be politically correct for a modern Hollywood movie to go into that sort of characterization and character assassination. But it's most people I talked to who saw that movie were just totally unfazed, like, well, so what? Or why would you even notice? But in any case, it kind of came out right as we were finishing our book up, and it was right between the eyeballs. My heavens. Historiography has a little more work to do to fill in this hole, and especially, so much has been accomplished in the last half century as far as people who've gotten the short straw along the way, but this seems to be the last major group that needs to be written back into our history. And that's what we're trying to do, especially on the American side of the line where most of the book takes place.
Why do you think French-speaking people in the West have been written out of stories so much? How and why has this happened?
Well, the need to simplify, the need to, whether they were journalists or, aspiring novelists or dime novel writers, as we say, or if they're modern academics, you give your audience what they want. And there's a kind of a reaction, feed the beast tendency that is, people have had a hard time getting beyond. And obviously, the East Coast narratives tend to dominate, and people are continually trying to put us back in line for those. And if I would One other quick quote I wanted to make that answers that question you just asked directly, I think is really superb.
Yeah, by all means.
Another one of the Midwestern historians to publish in the last couple of years, John Retta, in his book, From Furs to Farms, The Transformation of the Mississippi Valley, 1762 to 1825. Basically, it's a kind of a regional history of Illinois and Missouri. Very intriguing little snapshot here. But in his conclusion, he points out, again, addressing the real challenge in modern American historiography, the communities established by the French in the early 18th century were, by the eve of the Seven Years' War, parts of a prosperous, multi-ethnic, multi-racial society with an economy tied to international markets through the Great Lakes and the St. Lawrence River and via the Mississippi River and Gulf of Mexico to the Atlantic. Again, referring to Michigan and Illinois. Missouri and Illinois. Michigan is kind of a related story in any event. By looking at the Illinois country as a whole, I have argued here for the value of an approach to American history that places specific geographic areas at the center of their own histories instead of treating them reflexively as peripheries of an Eastern seaboard core. Doing so helps us better appreciate the social, economic, and demographic complexities that existed in various parts of North America prior to creation of the United States and challenges the conventional regional designations. And this challenges thereby the conventional regional designations that obscure the richness and variety of our local histories. So that says it all as far as I think the geographic straitjacket that we get into as we move further west into the continent is that stifling East Coast or feedback orientation of historians.
Well, then let's move beyond then the national narratives and stories told in Canada and particularly in the United States. And why don't you instead tell us about the facts on the ground of the French Empire in North America, particularly in the 17th and early 18th centuries, and especially tell us about the role of the Métis in sustaining that empire.
Yes. And again, the word empire is an interesting one because, of course, France did have an empire of sorts, but not at all like what we think as far as what the British, the Dutch, the Spanish, and Portuguese were up to in the Americas. The Métis enter the story basically because France never sent over a large population of settlers. And they were particularly short on women on the front end. Hence, a Métis population developed from the beginning and proliferated as the Canadians and then later on the Louisianais penetrated the interior of the continent. What you are facing here is basically that French Empire was one in which most of the resources, whether they're demographic or fiscal, financial, were to be retained in France, where France was trying to maintain their dominance in European politics. This was empire on a shoestring, and what they did is basically, once they carved out a few little enclaves in the St. Lawrence River Valley, they joined a sequence of Indian alliances that grew based on the local Algonquin and Huron tribes in their defense against the domination of the Iroquois to the south. And so you have more of an alliance system than you have a conventional empire. They never really attempted to dominate demographically other than the two regions at the first at the lower St. Lawrence River Valley in what's now southern Quebec, and then a century later, lower Mississippi and along the Gulf Coast and Louisiana. Gulf Coast, of course, including Mississippi and Alabama as well in that case. So you have definitely a different sort of empire that was based more on intermarriage with the locals. Obviously, the mestizo phenomenon in the Portuguese and Spanish colonies of the South was pretty common too, but at a much higher scale of intermarriage and interactivity, where the tribes of New France, as it could be called, La Nouvelle France, retained autonomy. This was a very loose alliance. They never came under domination, and much like the U.S. and NATO nowadays, the French were nothing more than first among equals, primus inter pares, and they were subsidizing the tribes. The tribes actually received tribute from France. France did not extract wealth from them directly. It was through trade mechanisms that they got some value back out of it. So so you have a different sort of empire. And then as we talk about a little later in the book, you have the peculiarity of after the Seven Years' War, what we call the French and Indian War, the fourth one of the French and Indian Wars that ended with the Treaty of 1763. Just before that, the French had signed in 1762 a treaty with their junior Bourbon dynasty, the one in Spain, and transferred for safekeeping the residual of their empire west of the Mississippi over to the Spanish for protection. And what's often forgotten is that it was during this period that Louisiana became much more French due to the fact that this west of the Mississippi refuge or safe haven became a primary option for refugees from the collapsing French Empire in the Americas, whether it be the Acadia, Quebec, the Illinois settlements, or even in the end, Saint-Domingue or Haiti in the Caribbean. Louisiana acquired something on the order of another 10,000 French-speaking refugees during the 40 years that it was theoretically under a very light Spanish Bourbon control. And then, of course, it was grabbed back by France under Napoleon and then hawked off to the U.S. in 1803, as everybody knows. But so, again, that's kind of a qualifier as far as, you know, a more conventional view of empires in North America.
You touched on this a second ago, but tell us a little bit more about how the 18th and the early 19th centuries were really a prolonged period of change in what today we would call the Great Lakes region or maybe the Old Northwest. Walk us through some of these changes and what they meant particularly for the French-speaking population there, and as well as for the popular narratives about the region's French and Métis history.
Yeah, okay. Let's see. In our chapters 3, 4, and 5 of the book, just making a general reference without going in too deep on that, 3 and 4 in particular, we focus on the middle ground or the Midwest or what the Canadians had always referred to as the Pays d'Onon or the upper country, which included Illinois, Michigan, and points in between, such as Indiana. And What occurred following the British conquest of Canada at the end of Seven Years' War is that, amongst other things, not only did the French-Canadian settlers of the Upper Mississippi Valley remain in place, they received thousands of reinforcements from Quebec as people continued to pursue opportunity where they could, further inland, regardless of who the overlords of the day were. You know, French imperial agents of yesteryear, British imperial agents starting in the 1760s. So we focus on a number of families, both Indian, Métis, and French Canadians. In chapter three, starting with the Montours, as one of the Freeman Jean Libre families that moved out of the Trois-Rivières part of the lower St. Lawrence into the Midwest, via Detroit, and ultimately ended up in Oregon and Montana, as in Western branches of the family. Then every step of the way, this is one of the prime examples, every step of the way they were intermarrying with yet another Native American tribe as part of the alliance, kin, and trading networks that was being developed, and Montour being one of the early families to turn this into a transcontinental saga. And then dropping back into the Midwest, where the story stays put, you have the interesting case of Marie Ruenza, an Illinois Indian living in the village of Kaskaskia in southwestern Illinois, daughter of one of the chieftains. And she enters history with an amazing amount of visibility through the Jesuit Relations that were later translated into English, the massive tomes of all the documentation and letters sent back from the Jesuit priests in North America over time. And Father Gravier tells the story of her as far as being his primary agent in converting the local Illini village over to Catholicism. And part of that saga, of course, is her two husbands, Michel Echo, who, much older, passed away before her, and then her second husband, Michel Philippe, and their very extensive farming operation that developed there, and ultimately a very successful trading center that her family was part of, her mixed blood offspring. And this whole story takes place before Daniel Boone was even born. So, you know, just trying to put things in perspective there and timeline. Then we also, again, drawing very heavily from Susan Sleeper Smith's book on French men and Indian women in the Midwest. We have the case of the Illini Métis, Marie Madeleine Raymond Chevalier. Originally Illini, but spending most of her time up in Potawatomi territory in Saint-Joseph, Michigan, which is just north of Notre Dame in South Bend, Indiana, right across the border, about a two-hour walk, maybe 30 minutes on a bike. But this is a very interesting tale. We summarize Susan Sleeper Smith's story there of the kin network, religion, and trade expansion throughout the Midwest. Again, a phenomenal story as far as reorienting one towards the reality of the American frontier before the Americans showed up. And which gets down to one of the primary points that I usually make at the very front end of any discussion on this matter, is the real problem comes down to in trying to, or how these people fell out of American history and our need to get them back in, is simply that most of the French Canadian West ended up in territory that ultimately became part of the United States. Hence, they fell out of the Anglo-Canadian national narrative in Canada, and they weren't written back into the American national narrative because they're Canadians. They really didn't belong. So you get this weird cop-out that goes back and forth, and we end up with these holes that are finally being filled. Again, the Midwest is leading the charge in these matters, and we're playing catch-up out here in the far Northwest. And then quickly, some of the other ones we touch on in Chapter 3 of the well-known in Michigan history, probably, but not elsewhere, the Ottawa Métis, her mother was Ottawa Indian, Madame Lafourmoise was of Michigan, who was is kind of one of the co-founders of Grand Rapids, Michigan, where her she took over the trading operation of her husband after his passing, and ultimately ended up in Michilimackinac as a lay teacher associated with a Catholic mission there, and met Tocqueville, of all people. Unfortunately, he didn't provide much detail on that encounter. Then we have Jean-Gabriel Serre, who represents later arrivals following the British conquest there in the 1760s, and moving inland to the French fort at Chartres, Illinois, working with George Rogers Clark over crossing from Illinois over to St. Louis, Missouri, and intermarrying, or his daughter actually married Auguste Chouteau, and her older sister marrying back into the prominent Panay family in Montreal, and you get a, through the family story, you see the extensive trade operations that continued there between Montreal and St. Louis. And ultimately, the story goes on to two of the Serre grandsons becoming prominent traders and public officials in Missouri. And the last thing is just very briefly, in we point out and go into a couple of the individuals involved with the early Michigan territorial history, when Michigan broke away from Ohio territory 1805 on a standalone. And we have the case of French major government and church leaders in early territorial Michigan, Pierre Audrin from France and Father Gabriel Richard from France, along with the bilingual John Griffin from Virginia, in showing how Michigan territory remained bilingual up through statehood pretty much in 1837. So that, and then we do a similar sort of thing moving, focusing more directly on Michigan in Chapter 4 and the Campo clan, and moving from Montreal into Detroit, Saginaw, Michigan, Grand Rapids, Michigan, and then ultimately out to Oregon. Chapter 4, we talk about Father Richard and the elections of 1823 and 25. He had become the, I think he still is the only priest ever elected to the U.S. Congress. And then how with the Erie Canal bringing in a flood of Anglo-Americans, his attempt at reelection failed by a handful of votes due to some gross intimidation and violence directed against the Canadians in Detroit, and some legal skullduggery associated with dismissing Métis votes up in Sault Ste. Marie. Another interesting tale of the American frontier that kind of falls outside the norm.
I have one more question about Michigan before we move a bit further west, because I'm kind of embarrassed to admit, I didn't know anything about Alexis de Tocqueville's visit to Michigan in 1831. Tell us what he observed there about the Great Lakes region, and kind of more broadly, what American governance and later what statehood meant for the local native and Métis populations in the region.
Excellent. I'm glad you asked that, because I was just debating whether to launch into that or not. So nice timing.
Good synergy.
The Tocqueville one is interesting because having found clues as to his being up there, and then in my standard text that I, you know, that everybody practically has read of, you know, Democracy in America, there's no trace of him up in that area.
Right.
And, you know, he's all over the up and down the Mississippi Valley in the Midwest, New England, the East Coast. But apparently what happened was when he went up there with his traveling buddy, fellow lawyer, doing their little study of the American penitentiary system, looking for excuses to actually do much more than that. He and Gustave Beaumont decided they needed to see real Indians on the frontier. And they documented this very thoroughly. And we cite from the original sources in French. And like elsewhere in the book, as you notice, we do translate immediately. We have limit the citations if the original source was in French, and then we give an English language translation. Apparently they reached, there was a modus in reading the biography of Alexis de Tocqueville by André Jardin. I get a strong sense that there was a understanding that Gustave was, de Beaumont was going to write the Indian part of the story, the frontier Native American story. And de Tocqueville hived his writings for publication so that that would not be published with it. And Beaumont later actually published his Michigan Territory travels and observations of the Métis community and Native Americans that he encountered there after de Tocqueville had passed away. So a posthumous publication that has since been separated from Democracy in America. And Beaumont actually did have a separate publication on the Native Americans, but he didn't fold de Tocqueville's material into that. He published separately. And I don't know if you want it or not, but his observations of the Métis and the Native Americans are just totally fascinating. I hesitate to get into reading those. Too much reading.
Can you summarize them a little bit? Can you tell us a little bit about what he did think, maybe without going into too much detail?
Well, let me. He had a very kind of sympathetic view. I mean, he was totally surprised the first time he met a French-speaking Native American, and he describes his surprise that they're very telling terms. You know, he was just dumbfounded, and then it went from there. But he tries to kind of psychoanalyze the Métis in particular as far as being of two minds and trying to reconcile their bicultural nature and situation on the frontier as living, cohabitating with, and serving as a very active intermediary between the retreating Native Americans and the expanding Anglo-American community. And there's quite a few pages in there drawing directly from de Tocqueville's observations, but they're prime examples of how perceptive that man was and how he kind of transcends the centuries of his ability to kind of capture and distill and interpret the things that would have, you know, been missed by folks living in the here and now. So
how did American governance then change the situation on the ground for the Métis and the Native populations in the Great Lakes region?
Well, and it's interesting, and here too, there's two basic stories as far as the Native Americans, and you know, the whole Jackson relocate the Indians west of the Mississippi theme that we're all familiar with. We associate more with, you know, south of the Ohio River, but It took place north of the Ohio River, too. But what happened as far as the American Midwest is you have to kind of draw a line just above the southern border of Michigan and just only around the kind of a, including the south end of Lake Michigan at the most. But all across Ohio, then Indiana and Illinois, under Jackson, there was a very aggressive implementation. And under his main man in the district, Governor Cass, who later joined the administration back in D.C., serving all the way through Buchanan, I think right up on the eve of the Civil War. But Governor Cass, a major factor in the history of the American Midwest. But what happened is north of that line, basically in all of Michigan and what became the independent territory and state of Wisconsin, the Native Americans were not removed. South of that line, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, they were almost completely removed. Very hard to avoid the militia, bounty hunter, and army units. They just, very few people escaped that sweep. And so you have a situation where the historian Badri Alvard later identified as far as his research during the 1870s that he figured that half of all the Métis in North America were actually located in Michigan. The most of those people now would refer to themselves as Chippewa because, of course, the rule in the United States has always been for the mixed blood community on the frontier was you're either going to get white or get Indian or stay Indian. But it's an either or choice. It's binary. There's none of the both of the above option wasn't even legal. And as far as the census taking until the 2000 census, we've had two of them now. It's finally allowed, but most people can't think in those multi-ethnic terms yet as far as two or more of the above instead of one or the other. But so you, that is a, without going into the weeds too much, that's an important consideration. So and it's somewhat like in the Pacific Northwest, Washington ended up the Indian Territory. Washington Territory was basically the Pacific Northwest Indian Territory, so Oregon could take the express route to statehood, which they achieved in 1859. We in Washington, let alone Idaho, Montana, didn't reach statehood until 30 years later, 1889. You kind of had a similar dichotomy in the Midwest, where Michigan and Wisconsin remained above the southern fringes, very much Indian territory, with a very heavy admixture of Métis, mixed blood, multilingual, and often Catholic tribal members.
So in 1867, as described in the book, Colonel Philippe de Trobriand of the U.S. Army observed from his post on the Upper Missouri that most of the traders in the region where he was stationed were of French extraction and that the French language was commonly spoken on the northern plains. Let's move further west, and why don't you tell us about the French and Métis legacy in the far west, and particularly the importance of French-speaking people well into the 19th century west of the Mississippi River.
Okay, and that so that would include a little more on Philippe de Trobriand's commentary.
Sure, yeah, if you want to.
Okay,
yeah, by all means.
I was just—it's a good kickoff point as far as perspective, and that's part of Chapter 5, following the two on the Old Northwest, Michigan, Illinois world. And Colonel Philippe de Trobriand is interesting. He was the highest ranking general of French origins during the American Civil War, serving in the Army of Potomac. And like Custer and others that were generals during the war, continuing out west after the war, they were colonels. Everybody had to go down a rank or two pretty much. To stay in the game. So this Colonel de Trobriand ended up posted there in the Upper Missouri. And he, after writing his and publishing back in France his history of the American Civil War from his direct experiences. He was out west and starting to put together in his mind from this deployment a book which ultimately came out in, as Vie militaire dans la Dakota, or Military Life in the Dakota. And citing just a few sentences from this book, in our book, I just provide this. There are, he observed when he got to the Fort Berthold there in the Dakotas, there are many French Canadians here. The traders at Berthold are French, with the exception of one. The half-breeds are all sons of Canadian fathers. My native language will certainly be a great help to me here. A little journal citation in the present tense. Then, and then he continues, it is notable that the French language is a good deal more common among them, the Native Americans, in these parts than English, which is a result of a great infusion of Canadian blood in the tribes. And so my basic bottom line comment on this interesting observation from 1867 in the Upper Missouri is, this is 64 years after the Louisiana Purchase and 61 years after Lewis and Clark had shot down the river in 1806 there after coming back from the Pacific coast. So this leads into another documented observation that we'll go into more depth in later volumes on, is that in interviewing people on Native Americans, tribal members in the Pacific Northwest over the last 10 years, it's amazing how many of them refer to their French-speaking grandparents and or mothers or fathers or great aunts and uncles or whatever. And you clearly through the 1970s and ever smaller numbers into the 80s, a significant portion of the tribal members in the Pacific Northwest were still speaking French, obviously just of the older generation, but kind of a interesting phenomenon that, again, doesn't make the local history books, but that, what, and again, it comes back to these families, like what Edmund said on the Potawatomi, these families have all played significant roles in the modern transformation of the tribal confederations, of which they are part, as participating in tribal leadership, not dominating, but, you know, participating. And it's definitely part of the modern Native American story, all the way across Dakotas, Montana, Washington, Oregon. So there's the northern borderlands have a particular history that warrants a little more attention in this regard. And let's see, as far as chapter five, you know, other than where we wrapped up with Colonel de Trobriand's observations in the northern Dakotas, a couple of quick comments. One in our in that chapter, La Haute Louisiane and the Far West, we cite Tanis Thorne's very significant statement as a factor pulling Canadian and Creole traders up the Missouri River, where she says basically the insistence of the native leadership meant that these alliances were deliberate attempts by chiefly lineages to monopolize the flow of trade goods and thus secure political status by marrying daughters and sisters to the merchant traders. And this is a key point as far as just this, you know, the agency of the Native American leadership was not sitting there just reacting, and they had full agency as to what they were about in these intermarriages. They were not simply a matter of exploitation or such matters, that this was definitely part of the whole kin network phenomenon, which has been a universal part of trade from time immemorial. as it's developed, and in particular between the white and Indian worlds in North America. There were two other families that, in trying to make this point that, you know, a sampling of individual family stories that, you know, that would hopefully suffice to reestablish the imprint of Canadians in the history of what's now the American West. We also have the example of Pierre-Louis de Lorimier and his Shawnee connection, intermarried with the tribe, ultimately starting his life out in Montreal at the Mohawk Oka Reservation, where his father was based out of. A loyalist family siding with the British after being loyalists under the French crown, ultimately moving into the Ohio country, becoming the floating Indian agent, de facto Indian agent for the Shawnees as they moved across the Midwest, ultimately into Missouri. And he was is credited with being town founder of Cape Girardeau. And Lewis, we cite in the book some of the interesting commentary of Meriwether Lewis when he came ashore as in 1803 when they were getting ready to winter and finish recruiting and head up the Missouri River. Then there's the one other example that we go into in the story is the Robidoux family, again, coming out of Montreal. And within three generations, they were on the Pacific coast in Southern California, in this case, via both the Santa Fe and Oregon trails. And they became virtually notorious traders along both, especially the Oregon Trail out there by Scott's Bluff, and very successfully taking full advantage of the Oregon Trail traffic. Very lucrative for them. Joseph Robidoux III is founder of St. Joe, Missouri, where one of my great-great-great-grandparents headed out on the trail from. And surprising in hindsight that you can have these consider major actors in the development of the American West, again, within a three-generation span of no more than 60, 70 years that take you all the way out.
Yeah, and it's as you describe it in the book, it's the fur trade in part, which is of critical importance, not just in the Great Lakes region, but also in the so-called New Northwest, or what we would think of today as the Pacific Northwest. And I particularly enjoyed this part of the book, as it was a history that I knew relatively little about. So can you tell us about Métis identity and the Astorians and the history of the French-speaking Pacific Northwest a bit?
Yes, gladly. Again, I'm trying to think, you know, when we talk about Métis identity, it's interesting because it doesn't fit into the standard identity framework in the sense that they would call themselves Bois Brûlé. Métis was a word in the French dictionary that was occasionally used in some fashion or another for, you know, people of mixed ancestry. But often they retained, and Tanis Thorne makes this point and numerous other authors, they retained a double identity, and it was an inclusive double identity. It was not exclusive. They could, you know, the opportunity and opportunism, whatever. They were loyal as often as not to both their heritages. And it was only a kind of a relentless thing over multiple generations of forcing a binary, you know, get white, act white, or be an Indian and live with the consequences type of scenario. So it's kind of a metamorphosis that, you know, it's hard to put your arms around. And that's what the Sebastian Mallette brought to the table for Michelle and I in his chapter 9, The Politics Becoming. He did a superb job of kind of explaining, at least on the Canadian side of the line, how this whole identity discussion and politics have evolved through the 20th into the 21st century. And the ongoing debate up north of, you know, the capital M Métis of, you know, the Canadian prairies and the Louis Riel and the Red River versus all the other Métis across Canada and in the U.S. who were not part of that particular subset of the transcontinental Métis story. And Sebastian actually serves as expert witness in a number of cases trying to interpret this from his employment there with Carleton University in Ottawa. He lives with his family over there on the other side of the Ottawa River in Gatineau, Quebec. But so any case, getting a little closer to the end of it on that, it's the whole thing with this, the rhizomatic model. You can see that it's to show that it's interconnection and inclusiveness as opposed to line drawing, exclusion, and either or choices. So he does a great job of taking us through that. And then part of the challenge was is south of the border. In Canada, of course, you could be both of the above. And the Métis are now recognized since the 1982 Constitution as one of the three indigenous peoples, along with Native American Indian types, as well as the they call First Peoples or First Nations and the Eskimo. But down in the U.S., again, they're either Indian with some white ancestry or they're white with a little bit of Indian ancestry. We're still stuck in this binary until the more recent census has allowed at least people to say both of the above, but there is no real identity here. And we do a quick summary in that chapter 9 of showing how from Michigan territory, these Métis families and Canadians were able to actually obtain individual land grants through the multiple treaties with the tribes that involved the tribes surrendering land, but setting aside specific land grants for the Canadians and Métis associated with the given tribe, Potawatomi, Ottawa, or Chippewa. And then you see in Iowa and Kansas, they would set aside a collective kind of mini reservation called a half-breed tracts. And then ultimately, following the Dawes Act, they had a more of a standard plan of forcing individual allotments onto the collective tribal approach to property on individual reservations. And interestingly enough, up in Montana, you have resorting to the old practice of drawing lines after the fact. And the U.S. Army would periodically find themselves forced into having to hunt down the Métis, which were labeled Canadian Indians, and deporting them back to Canada. Of course, these people were in Montana long before any Americans showed up. But somehow, if they spoke French and they said they had Cree ancestry, that meant they were on the other side of the border or belonged over there. And but they, most of them learned quickly to say, oh, no, we're Chippewa, which meant that somehow they were belonged on the American side. Martha Foster has a great book that came out about 10 years ago that tells this story. Phenomenal book. Let's see. There's a couple of several things here. I haven't touched on chapter 6, 7, or 8. I don't know if you want me to, of which of those points you want me to head into. Basically, the French Canadians were the first settlers of the Pacific Northwest. People often dismiss it and say, oh, they were fur trappers, and everybody knows the fur trade went away, so they went away, right? Well, no. Obviously, they had other lives beyond the fur trade, and most of them settled down where they were at. Very few went back up to Canada. They had spent their lives south of what later became a border, and there was no reason for them to relocate away from a lifetime of friends and in-laws with the local native tribes and the Métis community and the older Canadians that they'd come out with. And so we had a sprinkling of settlements, the largest of which is at French Prairie. I was down giving a talk at the state park there at Champouy last Saturday. And the names that are often listed there, I mean, there were many dozens of these families that were there before the Americans showed up, and their rights were protected under both the Treaty of 1846, the preceding joint national provisional government terms, as well as the when Congress and ultimately the Senate passed the Donation Land Claim Act of 1850. They were all they had to do was declare citizenship, and then they could, in accordance with the terms for homesteading or establishing their claims, they, like any American settler, could retain their property. So it was very, very thoroughly spelled out and generally effective here, with only limited examples of claim jumping and intimidation problems. The main issue that would come up, especially in Washington Territory in the 1850s, was, okay, they got their land rights, but their property rights, but we really want to give these guys voting rights. And after much debate, the vote in the first Territorial Assembly of Washington Territory, they agreed that they would give them the benefit of the doubt and they would have voting rights, inheritance, and such. I think in Oregon state history, the Canadians are included. It's in Washington, Montana history, their part of the story has been marginalized or almost totally omitted. And that's starting to change now, fortunately. We're getting them written back into the story here in Washington. And the Columbia Magazine, the quarterly of the Washington State Historical Society, has really been a leader in that.
Well, Robert, we've taken up a lot of your time today, but before I let you go, I have one last question for you. Now that this book is on the bookshelf, do you have any other projects on the horizon? What are you working on now?
This book is basically an introduction to a series that I've been working on now for 20-odd years, which basically take the story on into the individual tribes as the families over several generations relocate, generally in a voluntary manner, to live amongst their Native American kin. Not all, but many did, especially the males followed that route. The second book, this book pretty much tapers off in 1841, and just on the eve of the first wagon trains coming into Oregon. The second volume, which is almost completed, probably about 85% there, picks up in 41, and particularly Commodore Wilkes' arrival, and he and his crew in mapping the area identify a fair number of the Canadians that were here and they depended upon to show them around. And then we move through the 1840s, the settlement processes, the provisional government, the Treaty of Partition. The U.S. Army doesn't even show up till 49. They're preoccupied down in California. And then ultimately the partition into multiple territories, and followed by imposed treaties and the Indian Wars of 1856. There are three simultaneous Indian Wars in the Northwest, and that's where we end Volume 2. One in the Yakima Walla Walla Valley, one in the South Puget Sound, and the other one, and by far the bloodiest, in the Rogue River country of southwestern Oregon. So that's the next book, and then from there it's more focused on individual tribes and family stories around the Northwest. Though I probably do need to drop back for one more round into the Midwest somewhere in that process. We've got multiple articles that have been authored, finished, or virtually finished. One just came out on the métissage of the Canadian families in the Lower Columbia and the generation and spread of the Chinook Wawa, or Chinook jargon, which retained a fair amount of French vocabulary along with English, though predominantly Native American. And there's another article here on a Cowlitz French-Canadian Matisse family, the Plamondon, with a co-author, Michael Hubbs, that will be submitted shortly. It's a kind of a family story of a tribe that was not even recognized by the feds until the year 2000. The whole tells kind of the problem of a highly métissé tribe trying to negotiate. They refused relocation, hence they lost recognition, and the long struggle to maintain a tribal organization in the face of stonewalling and such. And let's see, and tomorrow, the next book I begin will be an intriguing example of all the new work coming out of Canada, the book by Peter Russell, Canada's Odyssey, a country based on incomplete conquests. Looking forward to that one in the book review here in Canada's History magazine. The reviewer says, we are now left with a shared space that still requires governance based on mutual respect and understanding. So that's definitely caught my interest. And one other thing I would like to say is that I would definitely like to forward to anybody that was so inclined on suggesting specific books and authors if they wanted to pursue the subject matter, be it in the Midwest with books like I mentioned of Tanis Thorne's, Gitlin's, Margaret Kimball Brown, and the great Carl Ekberg, or in the Pacific Northwest, probably the best book out on the subject from the Canadian side is Jean Barman's French Canadians, Furs, and Indigenous Women in the Making of the Pacific Northwest. This book came out, I think, about 3 years ago. Others out of UBC in British Columbia, Farming the Frontier by James Gibson, Making Wawa, Genesis of Chinook Jargon, George Lang, Richard Mackey's, and Bruce Watson's contributions to the subject matter. Out of Quebec, it's just been a motherload of recent publications as well, various works by Denis Vaugeois, Jean Provencher, and Jacques Lacourcière, and more recently, Gaston Deschênes, teaming up with Denis Vaugeois and Serge Bouchard. Let's just rattling names off, and without being too tedious, I'd be glad to clarify further on any of these, including some of the recent publications drastically revising the mythology on the founding of St. Louis, Missouri. So this whole subject matter is gaining traction very quickly south of the border. Canada, it's been, whether it's the Métis of the Plains and all the books by Jennifer Brown and Gerhard Eng and Heather Devine and Carolyn Produschny and others, the U.S., especially the Midwest, has really seized the subject by the horns, and level of scholarship has moved forward dramatically in the last 15 years. So there are lots of information available in a very well digested form now, suddenly.
Well, I'm glad that the subject is getting the coverage that it deserves, and I look forward to reading the next volumes in this series as well. Robert Foxcurran is an independent historian and is co-author, along with Michel Bouchard and Sebastian Mallet, of Songs Upon the Rivers, The Buried History of the French-Speaking Canadians and Métis from the Great Lakes and the Mississippi Across to the Pacific, which was published in 2016 by Baraka Books. Robert, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yes, and thanks for the interest and the patience.
The pleasure was all mine. Thanks again.